Hello, on this week's program, as Prison Quartet celebrates its 25th anniversary, David Patrick Stearns profiles the old saxophone group that has built a repertoire of more than 100 pieces. Susan Lewis looks at the way Phoenixville is reinventing itself through arts, culture and entertainment. The former mill town is getting set to stage its 11th annual Blobfest, an event that kicks off with the reenactment of a scene from the 1958 horror movie that made the Colonial Theatre famous. As they approach their busiest time of year, Tom Keel spends time with some of Philadelphia's historical interpreters, and we speak with Hardy von Anmüller, chairman of the board of the German Society of Pennsylvania. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
These are saxophones? They are when you're the enterprising Prison Quartet, a group that has commissioned over 100 works with an ear for the unexplored possibilities of an instrument that many people are surprised to find outside of jazz and rock and roll. The quartet has long been one of the more specialized parts of Philadelphia concert life and is currently celebrating its 25th anniversary. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns recently caught up with the group at rehearsals at the home of Matthew Levy, the last remaining original member of the quartet.
You didn't have to be a particularly eagle-eyed PBS watcher to see a familiar face in the widely broadcast season-opening concert of the Los Angeles Philharmonic under the celebrated young conductor Gustavo Dudamel. Saxophonist Tim McAllister, often seen with the Prism Quartet in smaller venues such as Trinity Center and Settlement Music School, had considerable screen time in the new John Adams orchestral work City Noir. That signifies an arrival of sorts. Classical composers don't often think to employ the saxophone. They aren't part of an orchestra's usual lineup, and McAllister had to be imported from Phoenix, Arizona. Prism's dream, though, is to have this much-in-demand American composer come to them in a piece specifically written for their four talents. McAllister and his colleagues are quietly militant about not letting any great composer slip away without writing a saxophone quartet.
We can't have people dying without getting a piece from them. You know, Leonard Bernstein died without us getting a solo piece. Aaron Copland was supposed to write a saxophone piece. You know, we have certain kind of dream composers we'd like to have write for us. But such as? Well, I mean, we've talked about John Adams. We've talked about Steve Reich. Yeah, I mean, you know, some people like that. So, you know, we at least want them to be aware of us.
Already, the group has commissioned new works from a huge variety of places. Composers who bridge the gap between classical and vernacular music, such as William Bolcom and Steve Mackey, as well as experimental talents who couldn't be further away from the saxophone's jazz heritage. One is Netherlands-based Jacob ter Veldhuis, better known as Jacob TV, who had the group performing with a pre-recorded tape of Baby Talk. The saxophone quartet is a medium with a spotty and not very well-known history, so without the weight of a distinguished classical music past bearing down upon them, composers seem to exercise a particular sense of freedom. And that keeps things, well, interesting, says Tamor Sullivan, a Prism member since 1994.
When you're involved in doing between 5 and 20 commissions a year, it's sort of like just tossing out the line, and you never quite know what you're going to get. And there are some that speak to us right away, and you know, we just crack open the score like, oh my gosh, this is going to be really an amazing piece. There are others that take a while to grow on us. One of our core pieces now by William Albright, which we think is one of the greats of the saxophone quartet repertoire, when the quartet got the first movement, was really a little bit stumped, as he'd say, like, well, you know, what is this? And the piece sort of had to teach us how to interpret it, and it took many years.
Many years, how many?
I'd say almost till, you know, probably a good 3 or 4 years to really grow into it in many ways. And now it's been, you know, 15 years later and we can't stop performing it. And every time it sort of shows us something new about it, we see a different angle to it.
The title of this section, appropriately enough, is They Only Come Out at Night.
The those in some ways are the most rewarding. And then there are certainly pieces where we get them and they stump us at the beginning and they stump us at the end, and we do our best to give a great showing of them. But, you know, they might go on the shelf after that.
Some of the best pieces come from composers who walk into a commission knowing next to nothing about the possibilities of the instrument. Such was the case, says Sullivan, with Coloratura by Katia Agoch.
She was a student at Juilliard at the time, never written for saxophone before, and came over and was just asking all these very basic questions about, well, what does the saxophone sound like when it does this, and what if it does this, and then started asking other things like, well, if the saxophone were to sigh, what would it sound like, or these things. So we sort of gave her this whole lexicon of things the saxophone could do, and she returned this amazing piece that we've just recorded.
The biggest problem in creating a modern saxophone quartet repertoire is finding a place in the chamber music world already dominated by string quartets. As a result, saxophone quartet tends to be a graduate school kind of thing, particularly at places such as the University of Michigan with a strong tradition of sax pedagogy. Saxophone quartets are increasingly making a strong showing in important chamber music competitions amid a general awareness that some of the most exciting possibilities in the future may lie in new music for instruments not previously considered concerto-worthy. So all the years that Prism has spent presenting its own concert series in Philadelphia haven't been for nothing, but they haven't been easy. All the members have full-time jobs around the country, Arizona, North Carolina. Levy, for example, is director of the Philadelphia Music Project. Now, at his group's 25th anniversary, he's bent on releasing 3 to 5 CDs of new works every year as a crucial means of consciousness raising.
There are lots and lots of people who just haven't heard a saxophone quartet playing concert music, and for them it's really eye-opening to hear the possibilities, you know, this sort of endless range of colors and sound and incredibly beautiful music that is capable on these instruments. And so that's part of our mission, to really disseminate, not only to commission new work, but to disseminate that work to as wide of a public.
So often, you wouldn't believe what the group is doing until you actually hear it. One CD is titled Antiphony, Music from China. Is everything possible here? So it seems. The music on the disc can be funny, menacing, eccentric, and always ear-opening. How strange that for so many years, the saxophone version of the Kronos Quartet has been right here under our noses, perhaps crowded out by so much else that's happening in Philadelphia. What makes Prism different from Kronos, though, is that Prism seems not to care about image, presentation, or looking cool. As a result, the Prism musical adventures go further afield, and maybe more consistently substantial.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Phoenixville, Pennsylvania once flourished with industry, but went into decline after its mills shut down and its jobs went elsewhere. In the last decade, it has been reinventing itself using arts, culture, and entertainment. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to this former mill town outside Philadelphia as it gets set to stage its 11th annual Blobfest, a quirky festival at the theater where this civic rebirth began.
This is downtown Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, about 25 miles northwest of Philadelphia. It dates back to the 1700s and was incorporated as a borough in 1849. Phoenixville was once the hub of iron and steel mills. Today, it's using the arts to help revitalize the community, starting with the Colonial Theater on Bridge Street. Phoenixville has been reborn more than once. The land sits at the juncture of the Schuylkill River and French Creek. In the early days, the waterways provided employment and resources. Its iron and steel mills would carry the town into the 20th century and even give it its modern name. Or, so the legend goes, says director of the Colonial Theater, Mary Foote.
The town was once named Manavon, and there's the story of the gentleman who owned the steel company, and he had his big house on the hill overlooking the company, and he saw the open hearth and the fire.
And he looked down and he saw the image of the phoenix coming out of the foundry.
Artist Lynn Miller, who paints, creates mosaic murals, makes giant puppets and stained glass, among other things, says the image of the mythological bird that was said to burn and rise from the ashes inspired him.
So he named the foundry the next day the Phoenix Works, and then the town changed its name to Phoenixville.
The town grew along with the local industry. In 1903, the Colonial Theater was built as a vaudeville house by Harry Brownback, in what Mary Foote says was an effort to give the town what New York and Philadelphia had.
And it was really a circuit between Philadelphia and Reading, where he would bring acts in who were on their way out west to Reading for shows.
When in the 1920s, vaudeville died out and film became the rage, the Colonial transformed into a successful movie house. The location was used in a 1958 hit, which made the theater itself something of a movie star.
Before long, the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of the Blob. Starring Steve McQueen and a cast of exciting young people.
The mayor of Phoenixville for the last 12 years and re-elected last year for a fourth term is Leo Skoda. A longtime resident, he recalls a thriving downtown in the 1960s.
Three or four men's stores, women's shops, shoe store, jewelry stores, hardware, you could name it, sporting goods. There was everything. And Friday, Saturday were booming days in the downtown. And within about 10 years, we lost all that.
With the closing of the mills and a nearby military hospital, the town was no longer a source of many jobs. It became instead, says the mayor, a bedroom community.
We sit in an area where we're 6 miles from the Great Valley Corporate Center, we're 6 miles from King of Prussia Commercial Center, and the pharmaceuticals are just up the hill here in Montclair and Oaks.
But unlike the diffuse and sprawling suburbs, Phoenixville had over 200 years of community history, including a real downtown area that needed some cleanup.
The year I was elected, 1998, you could look up Bridge Street and see all these empty storefronts. You'd see drug dealers, prostitutes out in the street at night, drunks stumbling out of bars. That was one of the things that I worked on as mayor through two very good police chiefs, and it's not something you can solve overnight.
But Phoenixville also had an infrastructure packed with traditions and collective memories, including structures such as the majestic Colonial Theater in the center of town. The theater had managed through the 70s and 80s as a place for pipe organ concerts, but in 1997 it went up for sale. Mary Foote was one of those who couldn't stand to let the theater disappear.
When you think about how a town is going to redefine itself, you have to look at what are its assets. So a group of us got together and raised $500,000 and reopened the theater. We got it up to code and got it open and started showing movies again, and have over the years added other programming.
The theater became the new anchor for community development.
You really need a reason for people to come downtown. So the theater creates that reason, whether it's for film or for a concert or for anything else. Once they're here, they need to eat, or they may shop for Christmas, or just walk around and enjoy the atmosphere.
An arts and entertainment strategy evolved as the mission of the Main Street Development Corporation, where Barry Cassidy came on as director in 2003. They started by restoring seats to the balcony of the theater so it could accommodate concerts. Then they turned to more local assets.
We had a strong arts contingent living right here in Phoenixville, a lot of artists, nationally known muralists, arts educators, and we built upon them.
The art strategy gained momentum. Events started small and then seemed to grow exponentially through word of mouth. Arts initiatives involving street performers, First Fridays, murals in the community, and then ideas that really wouldn't happen anywhere else. Like the annual Firebird Festival, in which a giant sculpture of a phoenix is newly designed, built, enjoyed for a few weeks, then burned to the ground. A wild idea that just ignited, so to speak.
That got started at a meeting where we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do. I went to the borough council and I said we decided that we want to burn a 20-foot bird every year. And everybody looked at us and shook their head and they smiled and said, great, and they voted that it was okay.
Or the annual Summertime Blob Fest, a 3-day festival that kicks off on Friday night with a reenactment of the scene from the Blob movie, where people flee the Colonial Theater.
We have a live stage show, and then 450 people are packed into the theater, and they run out at the same time, screaming and yelling and having a good time. We close the street, and there's another 1,000 people across the street watching. So it's a big night in Phoenixville.
So how have art and culture and funky festivals changed the downtown of Phoenixville? The ripple effect is clear to artist Lynn Miller, who moved here 15 years ago, and the Colonial Theater's Mary Foote.
10 years ago, there was 2 restaurants. Now there's about 13. Occupancy rate was around 30%. It's closer to 80% now. So most of it had their streetscapes improved, so it's just a wonderful difference.
When I first came here, I would ask myself, what am I doing here? But I started to notice a transformation in my life. And then I realized how this town was named from this very important story.
A story of an ancient bird who thrived, died, and rose again. Phoenixville is also rising, grounded by its historic structures, enriched by its art, and cultivated as a new magnet by a growing core of enthusiastic fans.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Phoenixville's 11th annual Blob Fest is next weekend from Friday through Sunday. It includes a Saturday street fair, screenings of The Blob, and self-guided tours of local attractions. As Philadelphia's tourist season reaches its peak each summer, Independence National Historic Park swarms with men and women dressed in colonial costume. Don't call them reenactors, though. These are historical interpreters who bring the 18th century back to life by taking on the personae of famous founding fathers or plain old Philadelphians. Now WRTI's Tom Keels reveals some of the tricks of the trade of the historical interpreter.
And someone would usually propose a toast. This was a big tradition at the time, and the toasts would get lively, and after everyone had put their toast together, whoever had proposed it would say hip hip, and everyone else would reply with huzzah. This may happen on our tour tonight. I want everyone to be prepared in case it does. So we're going to try it now. Hip hip!
Huzzah! Huzzah!
It's a muggy June evening, and a tour group for the Independence After Hours program is standing near the corner of Chestnut and Fifth, across from Independence Hall. Suddenly, an agitated man in knee breeches and a tricorn hat approaches. He introduces himself as John Dunlap, printer to the Continental Congress and a founding member of the First City Troop.
So I print everything that comes out of Congress, and I'm ever ready to fight for our freedom.
On this night, which Dunlap names as July 4th, 1776, he is searching for one particular congressional delegate.
But now I must find Mr. Jefferson. I have just received orders from Congress about an important printing job, and I must start setting the type for it immediately.
Over dinner at the City Tavern, we encounter Thomas Jefferson, who is dismayed by the last-minute changes Congress has made to his Declaration of Independence. After dinner, we follow our guide to Independence Hall, where Jefferson reads his revolutionary document to a rapt Ben Franklin and John Adams.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
These founding fathers are only a few of the 30 to 40 actors employed by Historic Philadelphia Incorporated, the nonprofit organization which runs Independence After Hours, Once Upon a Nation, and other tours in the historic district. Jennifer Hoffmaster is programming manager at Historic Philadelphia.
Here we call them interpreters, and I know within that you can say there's first person, there's second person, and third person interpretation. Here they are first person interpreters, and when you speak to them, they will speak as that person would speak to you. So they are in that time frame. And they're not supposed to come out of it.
A second-person interpreter is also a historical character, but one looking over his entire life like a ghost. A third-person interpreter does not portray a character, but dresses in costume to tell stories or teach about history. Historic Philadelphia's interpreters come from many different backgrounds, theater, academia, business, but all receive over 100 hours of training at a special school named, in honor of Ben Franklin, the Benstitute. There, they learned the basics of not only history and storytelling, but customer service and geography.
The actors do a lot of research on their own, especially if they want to portray famous figures such as Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson.
Only a select handful of interpreters portray famous characters like Ben Franklin or Betsy Ross. As Independence Day approaches, the demand for their services grows intense. Sometimes tourists might think they're seen double, especially in the case of Benjamin Franklin. The venerable Ralph Archbold has portrayed this favorite Philadelphian for decades, but he faces stiff competition from Bill Ochester, who appears as Franklin in historic Philadelphia tours.
They were looking for a middle-aged Franklin in order to do a press conference. I walked in, my supervisor saw me, and she just dragged me down to the meeting, literally shoved me into the meeting and said, "Look what I found."
Once Independence After Hours has ended, Bill Ochester and his colleague Steve Edenbow, who portrays Jefferson, repair to the City Tavern. Ochester, who is retired from the medical profession, has portrayed Benjamin Franklin since 2004. He also reenacts Revolutionary War battles with the 4th Continental Light Dragoons. Edenbow, a graduate of Dickinson College with theatrical experience, has portrayed Jefferson since 1999. As they order dinner at the tavern, both men are still in costume and in character.
How big is that salmon and trout for you?
It's essentially meant for one person. You're a big, big man, Dr. Franklin.
All right. Well,
if I were here with, say, Mrs. Jefferson, it would be enough for two.
Ochester and Edenbow rank among the stars of local interpreters. Besides their work with historic Philadelphia, both men make numerous appearances as Franklin and Jefferson at corporate, school, and private functions. While a novice interpreter with historic Philadelphia earns $13 an hour, Ochester and Edenbow can command hundreds of dollars for their appearances. The 36-year-old Edenbow is able to earn a full-time living portraying Jefferson.
I'm not going to recommend it to anybody. Not a viable career in a sensible kind of way. You never hear a mom say to her little girl, "Oh, honey, I hope you grow up someday and marry a nice Thomas Jefferson interpreter so you can take care of me in my old age." Doesn't happen. But you have to follow your passion.
Both Ochester and Edenbow have studied their characters extensively. Edenbow finds that an encyclopedic knowledge of Jefferson's accomplishments is necessary so that he can portray him either at a specific moment in time or as an omniscient ghost.
This morning I was Secretary of State Jefferson and Presidential Jefferson. Last night I had to be, I call it a timeless performance, where I'm sort of the alabaster bust. I know his whole life. I have to be very dignified, very, very under control, a good public speaker. And tonight, with this performance on July 4th, 1776, I get to be Hugh Grant as Thomas Jefferson, the bumbling, kind of lovable, but uncomfortable in public, but brilliant, sort of charming individual. And that's, so I get to be three different Jeffersons in the course of 24 hours.
Just like an actor preparing for a stage or screen appearance, Ochester sees a constant study of Ben Franklin as essential to giving a commanding performance. That's the only way to hold the attention of schoolchildren jaded by modern technology, or tourists exhausted by the hot Philadelphia summer.
Franklin is a massive character. I mean, you really need to know a little bit about everything and a lot about some things, and all my reading and everything sort of centers around Franklin now. Our greatest thrill is if we speak to someone and they respond to us as they would to Mr. Jefferson or Mr. Franklin. That is the greatest compliment that we can get.
Based on the reactions of passersby, both Ochester and Edenbow succeed brilliantly. Strangers yell hello, ask questions, and want to have their pictures taken with them. While Franklin and Jefferson might not be in the same league as Chase Utley or Ryan Howard, they still seem to have as many groupies today as they had in that steamy summer of 1776.
Americans all, and rouse your bold hearts at the liberty's call. No tears.
WRTI's Tom Keels. While both Bill Ochester and Steve Edenbow will be celebrating the 4th of July in Washington, D.C. this year, their fellow interpreters will be out in full force at Independence National Historic Park tomorrow, telling stories, leading tours, and teaching visitors about the birth of America.
Is what as free men our money will give.
Well done, we friends. Our last item this morning takes us to the German Society of Pennsylvania. Germans have been emigrating to the Philadelphia area since the late 1700s, many of them initially coming as indentured servants. I spoke with the chairman of the board of the German Society of Pennsylvania and a native son of Germany, Hardy von Elmuller.
I was born in Saxony, in Leipzig, the city of music and history and...
Kurt Masur,
yes.
People are clearly aware around the world of the influence of Germans to more rural parts of Pennsylvania. We have the Pennsylvania Deutsch, the Pennsylvania Dutch. And of course, in this area, we have Germantown. We have people like Rittenhouse, who were German and had a major influence on the area. What made Philadelphia particularly attractive to Germans?
Well, it was William Penn who actually invited the Germans to come here. He had decided upon receiving this land grant from the King of England to bring a few industrious people over here. So before he actually set out to come over to the United States or to the then colonies, he went to Germany and beckoned people who were desirous of coming over to the new colonies because of the religious strife that had been going on in the early part of that century in Germany. For 30 years, there was a religious war, an ugly one. Over a third of the population got killed in that war.
And the German society here has been around almost as long as Germans have been coming here.
That's right. We are soon going to be celebrating our 250th birthday. It was founded in 1764, primarily, as you said earlier, to help those indentured servants who, unbeknownst, when arriving here and sometimes owing some fare or other monies to the captains, were sold off to the landed British gentry.
A form of slavery.
Indeed.
The building we're in now, you moved into in 1888, and it's stunning. It's a wonderful, I guess, Victorian-era building.
Well, this particular townhouse actually was built in 1835. It's 50 years older, and it was at that time indeed a very respectable home. You are standing right now in the parlor.
Shall we walk into the main hall?
Yes, indeed. Please come along. This is our auditorium. It's called the Barthelmes Auditorium.
And this is a venue for, clearly for meetings of the society, but also a wonderful concert venue.
Yes, indeed. It has been built primarily as a concert hall. You can probably hear from the acoustics, it is beautiful concert hall for primarily chamber music, and we have a music program here that extends over the entire season of 10, 12 concerts. We bring in musicians from Europe as well as young Americans.
How do German people see classical music? Do they just regard it as their national music?
Well, I don't think they consider it their national music. They're very proud of it, of course, because in the 18th century, the major classical musicians and composers all lived in the central part of Germany, namely in Saxony and Thuringia. Weimar, Leipzig, Dresden, these are the cities where music abounded tremendously, primarily because these musicians came to the various Saxon princes and to their courts and were sponsored by them, if you would call it this way today.
But in much the same way that Italian people can understand opera without subtitles, you can, for instance, listen to Ode to Joy, and it's not just sound to you.
Well, Ode to Joy, indeed, and it has a very personal reflection on me because Friedrich Schiller, who composed the words to it, did this on my grandmother's estate. He met in 1785 with Mr. Kerner, who was another German poet, and so he went to Saxony. Saxon kings have always been very, very open to people from all over the world.
Final question. If I'm not German, not German-speaking, am I welcome here?
Anytime. We open up to our neighborhood. As you know, we are our neighbor to the one side is Chinatown, and to the other side, it's the Genoga area, Genogi area, which is primarily African-American. We have also here the Northern Liberties, which is a young, hip area. So we're right in the area of this, and we offer this, and they have sometimes gathering here too.
Artie von Ohnmüller, Chairman of the Board of the German Society of Pennsylvania. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.